Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Friday, March 10th, 2006. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Chris Andre.
Coming up on this morning's news, the Oregon Supreme Court rules against defendants' rights, the Dubai firm abruptly backed out of the U.S. ports deal, and in Iraq, the government executed 13 insurgents for the first time. Today's Portland area weather, rain or snow showers likely in the morning, showers likely in isolated thunderstorms in the afternoon, snow level rising to 1,000 feet in the afternoon. Highs around 45. Tonight, mostly cloudy in the evening, then partly cloudy. A chance of showers. Lows around 30.
The Oregon Supreme Court decided yesterday that criminal defendants are out of luck if they fail to object to aggravating factors that stiffen their punishments. It was not immediately clear how many inmates were affected by the ruling. The ruling's the latest, stemming from a 2004 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. That earlier decision cast doubt on Oregon's criminal sentencing guidelines, which take into account the seriousness of crimes and the criminal history of the defendants. They allow judges to use aggravating factors such as the use of a gun or racial motivations to impose prison sentences exceeding the guidelines. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that leaving such decisions to judges violates the constitutional guarantee in the Sixth Amendment of a trial by jury. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Too old and tired to get involved in politics? Tell it to 96-year-old Doris Granny D. Haddock. Haddock arrived in Eugene to kick off a four-day tour that includes a talk at the University of Oregon today, followed by visits to Portland and Klamath Falls. She was honored Wednesday night at Cosmic Pizza, where she signed copies of her memoir, Granny D, You're Never Too Old to Raise a Little Hell, and watched an excerpt from a documentary slated for broadcast on PBS, Granny D Goes to Washington. Haddock became a media celebrity in 1999, when at age 89 she began a 3,200-mile, 14-month walk across the country to bring attention to campaign finance reform. She covered 13 states and the District of Columbia, giving speeches along the way. When she decided in 2004 to run as a Democratic challenger to incumbent Republican Judd Gregg for the U.S. Senate in her home state of New Hampshire, election officials wouldn't let her include her nickname on the ballot, so she went to court to legally change her name. Haddock refused all donations from political action committees during the campaign and captured 34% of the vote. She launched her political career in 1960 at age 50, when she and her husband Jim successfully campaigned against planned hydrogen bomb nuclear testing in Alaska, saving an Inuit fishing village. Haddock advocates what she calls a velvet revolution. She said, "We need to change, but it has to be done with love, not anger. There's divine in all of us." This from the Eugene Register Guard.
11 pending lease applications for geothermal power on the flanks of Mount Shasta will be reviewed this year, according to Mount Shasta News. The Forest Service says the lease applications by the Bend, Oregon-based Vulcan Power Company date from 1992. The sites ring the mountain and consist of approximately 18,000 acres. However, Vulcan Power CEO Steve Munson said the company is only interested in developing one of the sites. The Forest Service says the 11 lease applications include sites west of Panther Meadows, south and west of the Mount Shasta Board and Ski Park. Geothermal power is generated by drilling deep wells to tap heated water and steam to turn electrical turbines. Proponents say geothermal is a clean, renewable energy source that's preferable to fossil fuels, coal, and nuclear power. Opponents claim geothermal plants will pollute the environment with toxic chemicals brought up by the drilling process to harness underground steam. Additional issues for those opposed to the plants are related to view shed and environmental concerns regarding transmission lines, cooling towers, and roads that accompany geothermal generation.
Oregon's last candidate to file in the state capitol before Tuesday's filing deadline was the first candidate disqualified Wednesday morning. Bruce Broussard of Portland filed paperwork Tuesday to be a Republican candidate against incumbent, a Democrat, Earl Blumenauer in Oregon's 3rd congressional district. The problem was that Broussard had filed months earlier as a Portland City Council candidate, and Oregon law prohibits candidates from running for two different offices at the same time. State law also says that in cases where a candidate files in two races, their candidacy is invalid in both. Broussard said he didn't realize he had to withdraw from the city council race before he could file for the congressional seat, and he apologized for the error. He had been planning to withdraw his city council candidacy Wednesday morning. One factor in Broussard's disqualification was timing. By filing as a congressional candidate in Salem just before Tuesday's 5 p.m. deadline for major party candidates in this year's elections, Broussard appeared in a photograph accompanying the Oregonian's Wednesday article about the filing deadline. The photo showed him holding a piece of paper with "enthusiasm" printed on it.
According to the Southwest Florida News Press, Lee County's Democratic headquarters had its second break-in in almost as many years this week. Thieves ignored computer equipment and other valuables and took the party's financial records and voter data. Computers were vandalized, but there was no sign of forced entry. The party's headquarters had a similar break-in shortly before the 2004 elections, when the office was in a different location near the thieves vandalized the office and stole records and computers in that incident. And just before the November 2004 presidential elections, vans used to carry voters to register to vote and cast early ballots had their tires slashed outside Kerry Edwards' headquarters in Royal Palm Square in Fort Myers, Florida. The vans carried pro-Democrat signs and bumper stickers.
The House approved a bill this week that would wipe out state laws on safety labeling of food, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. The bill would override tough rules passed by California voters two decades ago that require food producers to warn consumers about cancer-causing ingredients. The vote was a victory for the food industry, which has lobbied for years for national standards for food labeling and contributed millions of dollars to lawmakers' campaigns. But consumer groups and state regulators warned that the bill would undo more than 200 state laws, including California's landmark Proposition 65, that protect public health. Several critics argued that the bill was rushed through the House without complete hearings as a favor to a specific industry, at the same time that members are talking about the evils of lobbying and proposing stricter ethical rules. Under the bill, any state that wants to keep its own tougher standards for food labeling would have to ask for approval from the Food and Drug Administration, which has been criticized by food safety groups as slow to issue consumer warnings. The measure was approved after a debate in which House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco accused the Republican majority of shredding the food safety net that we have built in this country.
A day before parts of the U.S. Patriot Act were to expire, President Bush signed into law a renewal that will allow the government to keep using terror-fighting tools passed in the post-9/11 panic. Bush's signature came 2 days after the House gave final approval to the legislation over objections that it infringes on Americans' privacy. The president said the law has been vital to protecting Americans from terrorists. 16 provisions of the old law were set to expire today. Political battles over the legislation forced Congress to extend the expiration date twice. To get the legislation renewed, Bush was forced to accept new curbs on the Patriot Act's powers. These new civil liberties protections for the first time say explicitly that people who receive subpoenas granted under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act for library, medical, computer, and other records can challenge a gag order in court. But Republicans want to take the law into the upcoming midterm elections to show that they're acting to protect national security. The legislation renews the expiring provisions of the original Patriot Act, including one that lets federal officials obtain tangible items, such as business records, from libraries and bookstores in connection with foreign intelligence and international terrorism investigations. The law also takes aim at the methamphetamine trade by imposing new restrictions on the sale of over-the-counter cold and allergy medicines, which contain a key ingredient for the drug. Customers will be limited to buying 330 milligram pills in a month or 120 pills in a day. The measure would make an exception for single-use sales. This, according to the Oregonian.
More and more people, particularly Republicans, disapprove of President Bush's performance, question his character, and no longer consider him a strong leader against terrorism, according to an Ipsos poll documenting one of the bleakest points of his presidency. Nearly 4 out of 5 Americans, including 70% of Republicans, believe civil war will break out in Iraq, the bloody hotspot upon which Bush has staked his presidency. Nearly 70% of people say the U.S. is on the wrong track, a 6-point jump since February. Republican Party leaders said the survey explains why GOP lawmakers are rushing to distance themselves from Bush on a range of issues: port security, immigration, spending, warrantless eavesdropping, and trade, for example. The positioning is most intense among Republicans facing election in November and those considering 2008 presidential campaigns.
Dubai Ports World abruptly abandoned its plan for managing operations at six U.S. ports yesterday. The move diffused an election year showdown between President Bush and the Republican-controlled Congress over an issue that had become a political landmine for the GOP. The company's top executive, H. Edward Bilkey's announcement seemed to spread relief throughout the Capitol and the White House. It was unclear which American business might get the port operations. Just hours earlier, Republican House and Senate leaders privately told the president that Congress was all but certain to block DP World's plan. Under pressure from a disapproving public, a House committee overwhelmingly voted against it Wednesday. The leaders told Bush the Senate would inevitably do the same, despite his threats to veto any legislation killing the deal. The company's announcement gave Bush an out. He now doesn't have to back down from his staunch support of the United Arab Emirates-based company or further divide his party on a terrorism-related issue with a veto. The White House expressed satisfaction with the company's decision. Administration officials expressed surprise at the outcome. White House officials said that the decision was the result of conversations between Congress and the company and that senior administration officials were not directly involved in the talks.
Men's rights activists in the U.S. are to argue in court that fathers do not have an obligation to pay money towards raising a child they did not want. This from the BBC. The National Center for Men is fighting the case on behalf of a man who says his ex-girlfriend had his child after telling him she could not get pregnant. Activists say men should have the same rights as women in dealing with the consequences of unintended pregnancy. Women's and children's groups have criticized the planned legal challenge. Leslie Sorkey of the Association for Children for Enforcement and of Support said a child needs the emotional and financial support of both parents. Matt Dubay, the man at the center of the case, said he did not expect the court to rule in his favor. Dubay says that his former girlfriend became pregnant with his child after assuring him that she had a physical condition that prevented her from conceiving. He says she went on to have the baby, despite knowing that he did not want to have a child with her. He now wants the court to free him from his obligation to pay $500 in child support every month. The National Center for Men is filing a case on behalf of Dubay at a court in the U.S. city of Detroit. The center has dubbed the case Roe v. Wade for men after the landmark U.S. Supreme Court ruling that gave women the right to have abortions.
U.S.-funded broadcaster Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, is saying that two of its local reporters working in the Central Asian country of Turkmenistan have been arrested and taken to unknown locations. RFE, which offers the only Turkmen language alternative to the country's state-controlled radio, said it had also lost contact with its other reporters there. Turkmenistan's foreign ministry and police were not available for comment. Turkmenistan is a former Soviet republic bordering Iran and Afghanistan. It's been run by autocratic leader Saparmurat Niyazov since 1985. He calls himself Turkmenbashi, or the father of Turkmen, and encourages a personality cult based on himself. RFERL did not say how many reporters work for it in Turkmenistan. The Committee to Protect Journalists said in a separate statement, RFE employed six Turkmen service journalists to report on an irregular basis. The Turkmen authorities are refusing to speak with correspondents' families or give a reason for the arrests, this according to the BBC.
An Indonesian child has become the latest victim of bird flu, raising the country's death toll to 21. A World Health Organization-sanctioned laboratory confirmed that the three-year-old boy who died from the disease, according to the BBC. The child is thought to have been in contact with sick chickens shortly before he became ill. More than 90 people have now died of the H5N1 strain of bird flu since 2003. The vast majority of the deaths have been in Asia, but in cases in people and birds have also been recorded in Europe and Africa. Almost all the deaths have been linked to contact with infected poultry. Experts fear the virus could combine or mutate into a form that passes easily between humans, possibly sparking a pandemic, but there is no evidence that this has happened yet.
Israel's acting Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, said Israel will determine its border with the West Bank in the absence of negotiations with the Palestinians and then build a wall and move all settlers to the Israeli side. Yesterday, Olmert said Israel will draw its final borders by 2010, for the first time setting a deadline for what is expected to be a unilateral, large-scale West Bank pullout. Olmert, in comments carried by the Yediot Aharonot daily, also threatened to assassinate incoming Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas if he's involved in terrorism, a threat made Tuesday by Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz. He said that if the Palestinians resume attacks against Israelis, then Israel will change the path of its separation barrier in the West Bank according to national consensus. Olmert, facing elections on March 28th, said the current barrier still under construction after more than 3 years is a security fence.
More than 250 medical experts have signed a letter condemning the U.S. for force-feeding prisoners on hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The doctors said physicians at the military prison had to respect inmates' right to refuse treatment. The letter in the medical journal, The Lancet, said doctors who use restraints and force feeding should be punished by their professional bodies. Some 500 terror suspects are being held without trial at Guantanamo Bay. The U.S. has argued that the Geneva Convention does not apply to prisoners at the camp, who, it says, are enemy combatants who continue to pose a threat to national security. Human rights groups and the U.N. have urged the U.S. to close down the facility. Amnesty International said the troubling accusations in the doctor's letter underline the need for independent medical examination of the prisoners. An open letter in The Lancet was signed by more than 250 top doctors from seven countries, the UK, the US, Ireland, Germany, Australia, Italy, and the Netherlands. The doctor said the World Medical Association specifically prohibited force-feeding detainees at the camp, have said hunger strikers were strapped into chairs and force-fed through tubes inserted in their noses. This from the BBC.
The U.S. military said yesterday it would begin moving thousands of prisoners out of Abu Ghraib prison to a new lockup near Baghdad's airport within 3 months and hand over the notorious facility to Iraqi authorities as soon as possible. Abu Ghraib has become perhaps the most infamous prison in the world, known as the site where U.S. soldiers tortured Iraqi detainees. Abu Ghraib currently houses nearly 5,000 out of the nearly 15,000 detainees held by the U.S. military in the country. Iraqi authorities also hold prisoners at other prisons throughout the nation. The U.S. government initially spoke of tearing down Abu Ghraib after it became a symbol of the scandal. Widely publicized photos of prisoner abuse by American military guards and interrogators led to intense global criticism of the U.S. war in Iraq and helped fuel the Sunni Arab insurgency. But Abu Ghraib was kept in service after the Iraqi government objected. Planning for the new facility at Camp Cropper began in 2004. Some proponents of the move say that Iraqis are all but certain to use Abu Ghraib as a jail for some time. But yesterday, opponents said that Iraq plans to discontinue the use of Abu Ghraib as a detention facility.
Iraq hanged 13 insurgents yesterday, marking the first time militants have been executed in the country since the U.S.-led invasion ousted Saddam Hussein nearly 3 years ago, the government said. The cabinet announced listed the name of only one of those hanged, Shakar Farid, a former policeman in the northern city of Mosul. Farid allegedly confessed that he had worked with Syrian foreign fighters to enlist fellow Iraqis to carry out assassinations against police and civilians. In September, Iraq hanged three convicted murderers, the first executions since the 2003 ouster of Saddam. They were convicted of killing three police officers, kidnapping, and rape. Iraqi authorities reinstated the death penalty after the end of the U.S.-led occupation in June 2004, so they would have the option of executing Saddam if he is convicted of crimes committed by his regime. Death sentences must be approved by the three-member presidential council headed by President Jalal Talabani, who opposes capital punishment. In the September executions and again in Thursday's hangings, Talabani refused to sign the authorization himself but gave his two vice presidents the authority.
A suicide bomber detonated an explosives-packed truck at a checkpoint at the edge of Fallujah today, killing 7 civilians and wounding 5. The bomber attacked as many cars waited to pass through the security checkpoint into the city 40 miles west of Baghdad. A large explosion set fire to a U.S. battle tank in East Baghdad today. There is no immediate word on casualties. AP television news footage did show, however, the Abrams battle tank in flames, its tracks blown off. There was no sign of the vehicle's occupants. The U.S. military had no immediate information on the incident.
The fourth session of the General Conference of Arab Parties in Damascus this week voiced support for Iran's right to acquire peaceful nuclear technology. Secretary General of the Congress of Arab Parties, Abdul Aziz Al-Sayed, told reporters at a press conference held at the end of the three-day session that Iran was being targeted by big powers because it was a regional power with policies that did not please these powers. Arab countries treat Iran as a Muslim brother state, the official said, and added that Arab states desired good relations with members of the Islamic world. The fourth session of the General Conference of Arab Parties concluded its work in Damascus Tuesday evening by releasing a statement listing major developments in the Arab world, including Iraq, Palestine, and Lebanon. The participants, representing 16 Arab nations, in the statement called for the enactment of transnational law punishing the desecration of religious sanctities, such as the recent blasphemy committed by a number of European newspapers against the Holy Prophet of Islam. The statement also called for a similar law punishing occupation of a sovereign state by any foreign power, punishment of occupying forces, and payment of compensation to victims of foreign occupation. Expressing support for the Islamic resistance in Palestine and Lebanon, as well as the armed operations against occupying forces in Iraq, the participants in the statement declared May 25th of every year as Day of Resistance. This from the Islamic Republican News Agency out of Damascus.
Russia's Itar Tass news agency reported yesterday that Iran is prepared to agree to the enrichment of uranium for its civilian nuclear program and subsequent recycling of spent fuel in Turkish territory. The Iranian ambassador to Turkey said both countries have commitments under international agreements they are determined to comply with. We plan to discuss some proposals for uranium enrichment and spent nuclear fuel processing in the future. Ambassador Detlev Abadi explained that all issues were being discussed within the framework of efforts for enhancing security in the region and that the Iranian nuclear program does not have a military dimension.
A U.S. aircraft's assault in a far-flung village in eastern Afghanistan in the wee hours yesterday left 2 persons, including a woman, dead and 2 others, including a child, wounded, according to Xinhua News Service. An Afghani press officer told Xinhua, 2 persons, including a lady and a rebel, were killed and 2 others, including a child and an anti-government militant, wounded the U.S. aircraft bombed Khandi Bagh village in Chakrapar district of Nangarhar province last night. The strike, he said, took place when the militants hidden in a house rejected Afghan troops' calls to surrender. He said the U.S. aircraft pounded the house, killing 2 persons on the spot and wounding 2 others early this morning.
A crowded bus carrying a wedding party hit an anti-tank mine earlier today in a volatile region of southwestern Pakistan, killing at least 30 people and wounding 8. Dr. Sher Zaman, who tended to the injured, said the dead included 21 children, 5 women and 4 men. Officials said rescuers took the injured to hospitals as swiftly as possible in the remote mine-laden area. Residents told the Associated Press that no ambulances or government medical teams reached the victims until 7 hours after the blast. Zaman said, "I am treating the injured in an open farm field." The bus had been traveling to a wedding in the town of Rakhni. The explosion in Dera Bugti, about 180 miles east of Quetta, did not appear to be deliberate. The area has been wrecked by an increasing number of bombings, rocket attacks, and landmine blasts in recent years.
Almost 20% of the world's population still lacks access to safe drinking water because of failed policies, an influential report has concluded. The UN World Water Development Report also blames a lack of resources and environmental changes for the problem. The study calls for better leadership if a goal of having the proportion of people without water proper access to safe water by 2015 is to be achieved. The findings will be outlined next week at the World Water Forum in Mexico. Described as the most comprehensive assessment to date of the world's freshwater supplies, the report said that politicians, businesses, and aid charities all had a role to play in addressing the problem. Although steady progress has been made in recent years, it said that more still needed to be done. UNESCO, which headed the group of 24 UN agencies that compiled the data, said the report highlighted the need for stronger leadership and coordination. Unless there was a marked improvement, the report warned, regions such as sub-Saharan Africa would not meet the UN Millennium Development Goal of halving the proportion of people without access to safe drinking water between 1990 and 2015. This from the BBC.
The Dalai Lama today said that he's asked China to let him visit the country for the first time since he fled Tibet nearly a half century ago. His comments came in an address to thousands of followers on the anniversary of the 1959 uprising in Tibet against Chinese rule, which marked the beginning of his exile. The supreme Tibetan spiritual leader did not specify an itinerary, but said he wanted to make a pilgrimage. His envoys conveyed his request to the Chinese government. The Dalai Lama told his followers, "As a country with a long history of Buddhism, China has many sacred pilgrimage sites. As well as visiting the pilgrimage sites, I hope I'll be able to see for myself the changes and developments in the People's Republic of China." The Dalai Lama has repeatedly said he wants autonomy, not independence, for Tibet.
A court convicted 9 Muslims earlier today of belonging to a terrorist group because they incited hatred for non-Muslims. Among the defendants were Mohamed Bouyeri, the convicted killer of filmmaker Theo Van Gogh. Bouyeri, who already had been sentenced to life in prison for the November 2, 2004 murder of Van Gogh, was found to be a leader of the group, but the judges said he could not be punished further. The judges said the group's goal was stirring up and or inciting hatred and or threatening non-Muslims. The heaviest sentences were given to Jason Walters and Ismail Ankink, who was found guilty of attempting murder when they threw a hand grenade that wounded 5 police officers on November 10, 2004. Walters received 15 years in prison, while Aknik received 13. The other members were given sentences ranging from 1 to 5 years.
The Association of Prostitutes of Bahia State in Brazil has won government permission for a radio project enabling FM station Radio Zona to start broadcasting in the second half of the year. Project coordinator Sandro Carreira said today, "We are not going to apologize for prostitution, but we are going to struggle for the dignity of the profession. The aim is not to attract women to the business. The station will feature programs about the trade, but will also discuss issues such as human rights, social questions, and sexual abuse. Working girls and media professionals such as Correa will staff the station and will give prostitutes training in alternative jobs." This, according to Reuters. KBOO Morning News for Friday, March 10, 2006. Portland area weather today, rain or snow showers likely in the morning, showers lightly and isolated thunderstorms in the afternoon. Snow level rising to 1,000 feet in the afternoon, highs around 45. Tonight mostly cloudy in the evening, then partly cloudy, chance of showers, lows around 30. Saturday partly sunny in the morning, mostly cloudy, scattered showers, slight chance of thunderstorms, highs around 45, lows 30 to 35. Sunday mostly cloudy, scattered showers, highs around 45, lows 30 to 35. Thanks for joining us this morning. The morning's newscast was edited by Becca Bartelson and Chris Andre. Our engineer is Becca Bartelson and Kathleen Stevenson. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Chris Andre.
Becca Bartelson.